Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Jody Cowan.
And I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin by reviewing pending climate legislation with Eric Weltman of Water and Food Watch, who spoke with Mark Dunley. Then Troy Prep Club interviews Daryl Camp, a reporter for WMHT. Later on, Bert Weber, co-founder of Common Roots Brewing Company, talks with us about creating the Common Roots Foundation. After that, we continue the conversation with Lila June, a community organizer who spoke with Anna Steltenkamp for the Indigenous Voices series. And finally, we hear from two young girls who attended the last weekend's Girls Inc. and speak about their experiences learning STEM. But first, here are the headlines.
Federal COVID relief funds will shortly begin flowing to local communities. The TU reports that New York will receive $12.7 billion, while Albany County will receive $59.3 million, and the city of Albany will get $80.7 million. Governments can use the money to pay for public health expenses, address negative economic impacts from the pandemic on workers, businesses, and the public sector, replace lost revenue, provide premium pay to essential workers, and also use it to improve water, sewer, and broadband infrastructure.
The New York State Correctional Officers and Police Benevolent Association filed a federal lawsuit Friday that seeks to overturn a new law banning prolonged solitary confinement in state prisons. The suit argues that decreasing segregation practices has led to an increase in violence against both employees and inmates since 2012.
The Times Union reports that Albany County has launched a pilot program to reopen congregate meal sites for seniors across the country. The first step was the resumption of meals at the Watervliet Senior Citizen Center. The other 16 congregate meal sites around the county will be open in stages.
The Board of Regents on Monday adopted a new statewide policy that calls on school districts to consider acknowledging the role racism plays in American society. The Regents is directing local schools to examine their diversity and equity policies.
The Gazette reports that Schenectady County has achieved the second highest adult COVID vaccination rate in the state, 71.3% as of Monday morning. Albany is at 67.7%, while Rensselaer is at 61.7%.
And our final headline comes from Public News Service.
Nurses say passage of bills to set and enforce adequate nursing staff levels at New York hospitals and nursing homes will save lives. The bills passed in both the state Senate and Assembly with bipartisan support. Once signed into law, they will affect every hospital and nursing home in the state, both public and private, according to New York State Nurses Association President Judy Sheridan Gonzalez. Hospitals ultimately will be required to abide by minimum nurse-to-patient ratios set by clinical staffing committees annually, and nursing homes will have to meet standards for daily nursing time for each resident.
This law is a pathway toward getting the kinds of supports that patients need in order to get the care that they deserve.
Opponents of the legislation say it will strain the resources of financially struggling long-term care facilities. Governor Andrew Cuomo has not said if he will sign the bills. The Nurses Association says understaffing at New York hospitals and nursing homes has been a chronic problem, and Sheridan Gonzalez notes the pandemic added urgency to finding a solution.
This is what the trauma was that we faced during COVID, making life and death decisions based on scarcity. We had staffing based on scarcity. We had PPE based on scarcity. And people got sick and died directly related to that.
The law will require the State Department of Health to establish new minimum staffing standards for ICUs and critical care units that must go into hospitals' annual staffing plans. And Sheridan Gonzalez points out the law requires hospitals to make staffing data publicly available to staff and patients.
Now the public will be made aware. There's transparency and accountability in what hospitals actually have on deck taking care of patients.
The bills also establish an independent commission to study the effectiveness of the new law and to make recommendations for further legislative action. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
And that's it for headlines. For those of you that are just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, coming from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
Our mission is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from sanctuary sustainers. To learn how you can contribute to the media, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390.
Eric Weltman of Food and Water Watch reviews pending climate legislation before the New York State Legislature, which is due to adjourn on June 10th. He talks about the need to halt new fossil fuel infrastructure, including the Danskammer plant near Kingston, as well as public power. This segment provided by Mark Bellamy for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're talking with Eric Weltman, who's I know him as a senior organizer for Brooklyn for Food and Water Watch, and one of the nation's and New York's preeminent climate change, fossil fuel, water groups. And we wanted to talk to Eric Weltman about, you know, what are some of the key issues that Food and Water Watch is pushing at this point in New York State, particularly with the state legislative session, you know, ending in about a month or so.
Thank you. Thank you very much, sir. You know, as folks may recall, Food and Water Watch was amongst the organizations pushing Governor Cuomo successfully, you know, to ban fracking. And Governor Cuomo remains a key target for many of our, you know, concerns, including the build out of frack gas infrastructure. But with the Democrats holding a supermajority in both the Assembly and the Senate, you know, we see a real opening for, you know, passing bold climate legislation over the next few weeks, noting, though, that the legislative session does end on June 10th.
Well, I know one of the things that Food and Water Watch has been pushing more recently has been the concept of, you know, public power. You know, why do you think public power, you know, democratic control over our energy system is helpful at this point? And what are some of the proposals that you're hoping to see the legislature enact on that?
Absolutely, Mark. Food and Water Watch believes that public power is the perfect vehicle for not only promoting renewable energy and helping us move off fossil fuels, but also creating affordable, accessible, reliable, and very importantly, accountable clean power. We've long been supportive of public water, and we're very much against corporate control and abuse of our most vital resources, including, as I mentioned, you know, our water systems, as well as our food systems, our food production. Well, we have the same analysis of the production of energy. Along with, you know, many allies across the state and across the country, we are embracing public power, you know, again, as a vehicle for moving off fossil fuels, for stopping our reliance on dirty frack gas. We are, as I mentioned, you know, continuing to target Governor Cuomo around stopping frack gas infrastructure, pipelines and power plants that transport and burn fracked gas, including the Danskammer power plant up in the Hudson Valley. And here in the city where I live, there are fracked gas proposals, power plant proposals in Brooklyn and Queens. And again, Governor Cuomo has the authority to stop these projects. But as I mentioned, you know, we are pushing a number of legislative proposals that we hope to pass by June 10th, including, I'll just list them off briefly, the New York Build Public Renewables Act, as well as the Clean Futures Act. And those are both bills that we're hoping the legislature will embrace, support, and pass by June 10th for the governor's signature.
Well, one of the things that the, I guess, Build Renewable Act does is it pushes the New York Power Authority, which you know, basically owned by the state, to build renewable energy in New York State. Now, that was actually something that Governor Cuomo proposed a couple of years ago, but was sort of defeated by the industry, you know, who wanted the profits to go to the private developers. How has, you know, the governor reacted to the new proposal that, you know, Food and Water Watch and a number of other groups are pushing with respect to overhauling NYPER to be more focused on renewables?
That's a good question. I do want to note that this really harkens back to the, you know, the Great Depression and Governor Roosevelt, you know, back in the day. I think, you know, he was amongst those responsible for the creation of the New York Power Authority, which, you know, largely operates, you know, owns and operates, you know, hydropower facilities in upstate New York, and has a tremendous track record, of affordable, accessible, reliable, clean power. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, we want to unleash the power, so to speak, of the New York Power Authority to help us, you know, meet New York's climate goals. To be honest, we have not heard yet from the Cuomo administration about this bill. We're in the process of building up a tremendous base of co-sponsors in both the Assembly and the Senate. And I do want to encourage, you know, your listeners, if you're amenable to doing so, to contacting your own legislators, the bill number in the Assembly for the New York Build Public Renewables Act is 1466A. Again, that's 1466A. In the Senate, the number is 6453. The sponsor in the Assembly is Bobby Carroll from Brooklyn. And the sponsor in the Senate is likewise Senator Parker, you know, also from Brooklyn. So, you know, again, we have until June 10th to pass this bill in the legislature, along with the Clean Futures Act, which would ban new fracked gas power plants and then send them to the governor's desk, hopefully for his signature.
And just to clarify for people, there is a federal Clean Futures Act, which Congressman Tonko is one of the main sponsors of, which has drawn quite a bit of criticism for support of what we would call false solutions, such as garbage incineration and carbon capture. But this is the state Clean Futures Act, so it's a different bill. You mentioned a couple times the Dan Scammer power plant, which I think is about an hour and a half south of Albany. Can you give us a quick overview of why is that such a critical issue, and what can the governor and the state do about it?
Absolutely. So just like the governor, you know, banned fracking, Governor Cuomo and his agencies, in this case, the Department of Environmental Conservation, they have a tremendous amount of authority, even without, you know, a new bill or a new law to stop frack gas pipelines and power plants. Food and Water Watch is working with a tremendous number of allies. NYPERC has been very active in the fight against Dan Scammer. Scenic Hudson, a bunch of local groups are opposing this project. It's right on the banks of the Hudson River. It's in an environmental justice community, a low-income community of color in the city of Newburgh. And it would boost our reliance on fracked gas at a time of which, needless to say, we need to move off fossil fuels. As folks are probably aware, the state has some very ambitious climate goals that were established in the CLCPA. We cannot meet these goals. This should be fairly obvious, but New York cannot meet these goals unless Governor Cuomo stops any and all new fracked gas infrastructure in New York. We cannot be increasing our reliance on fossil fuels at a time when we need to be moving off fossil fuels. And again, you know, utilizing the capacity of the New York Power Authority, you know, building out a clean energy future reliant on renewable energy.
So we have about 90 seconds left. So I'll give you a two-part question. One is, I know that you guys have been involved with the I believe it's called the campaign for a Green New Deal in New York. What's happening with that? And if people want to find out more about Food and Water Watch and your work on public power and other legislative issues, how best can they do that?
Absolutely. So the campaign for Green New York is now also shifting its focus to the Clean Futures Act, which again is the legislation that would ban new fossil fuel power plants. And that's legislation that was introduced by Senator Ramos, Senator Jessica Ramos, and Senator Mondani, from Queens. So that's a bill that we're also hoping to pass, in the legislature by June 10th. We have a website, foodandwaterwatch.org. We welcome folks visiting, again, foodandwaterwatch.org. We also have our own New York Facebook page. So if folks are on Facebook, you can check us out. And also you can sign up for text messages by texting ACTION, A-C-T-O-N, I think that's how you spell ACTION, A-C-T-I-O-N, that is, to 69866. So again, text the word ACTION to 69866. And you can get all kinds of updates from Food and Water Watch here in New York.
Well, thank you very much, Eric Weltman, Food and Water Watch. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That was Mark Dunley speaking with Eric Weltman of Food and Water Watch and looking at the cause of clean and accountable, affordable power food. Thank you for that.
All right. For our next segment, we move to the Troy Prep Media Club. Members Caitlin Miller, Talisi Chestnut, and Treasure Irving interview Daryl Camp, a reporter for WMHT, New York Now. Camp describes how he makes media and offers advice to the young journalists.
I am Caitlin Miller. I am a member of the Troy Prep Media Club. And today we are speaking with Daryl Camp. Can you introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Daryl Camp. I'm a reporter for WMHT, mostly for New York Now, and I have been a reporter for about 8 years.
I am Kaylee, and I'm from a member from Troy Prep Media Club. And how did you get started in journalism? Who encouraged you at the start of journalism?
I didn't actually get encouragement to go into journalism. My encouragement from the time I was a kid was to go into radio, because the way I sound right now, it's how I've sounded since I was about 13 years old. So people always said, hey, you have a great radio voice. So I ended up going to radio school and preferring the talk side of radio, and talk radio is news driven. And that led to me becoming a reporter.
Were you shy when you first started journalism or when you first started talking on the radio?
I wouldn't say I was shy exactly. I was often nervous. I've never really been particularly shy. I have no shame, and I have a general disregard for the way I appear. So I wouldn't say I was shy, but it was something I was really nervous about, because when you're talking about news, you're talking about details and you don't want to get anything wrong. So I was really concerned and nervous about how good of a job I was doing, but that's something even outside of media that you'll find. If you care about what you're doing, sometimes you'll be nervous, and that's fine.
What was the most challenging thing about doing journalism?
The most challenging thing by far is scheduling, because often you will need to talk to people who don't want to talk to you, because there may be a story you're writing about them that they don't want out there for a number of reasons. And a lot of people, even when they do want to talk to you, they have really busy schedules. So they're like, hey, I'll get back to you about this. And when everybody you try to schedule an interview with says, hey, I'll get back to you, it's really hard to figure out your timing. But after a while, you figure out how to manage that and get into a rhythm. But scheduling, whether it be because people are uncooperative or because they're really busy, is probably the hardest thing.
Who is the most famous person you've interviewed?
I don't know exactly how to answer that question, because it depends on who you are. So when I was at my two jobs ago, actually, Jams 96.3, I got to interview a lot of comedians, Marlon Wayans. I don't know if you know who that is, of the famous Wayans family I interviewed. I have had back and forth exchanges with the governor, Governor Cuomo. That's pretty routine if you cover the Capitol. I interviewed Bruce, another comedian. There are a ton of people. Nick DiPaolo, that's another comedian. Who wasn't a comedian that I've interviewed? Maybe an artist. Ben Stiller is a guy that was at the Capitol last year. That was a good time talking to him. That's probably the most famous person actually has Ben Stiller, I would say.
Also, what is your most favorite article or story that you've found?
Favorite article or story? I would say the most engaged I've ever been. I don't exactly have a favorite, but when I felt most fulfilled was covering the criminal justice reforms that went into effect early last year. So over the course of 2019, people were both for and against it, and it was probably the most thorough I've ever been as it relates to getting every side of a story. There aren't actually two sides of every story. There are more like five or six, because there are degrees of pro and con. So I'd say the most fulfilled I've ever felt was covering the state's criminal justice reforms.
What tips do you have for young journalists like ourselves?
A few things. First of all, always be as honest as possible and responsive to evidence. What you don't want to do is come to a story with a pre-existing narrative about the story, because that will show in your work. You want to always have an open mind about the thing that you're addressing, as if you know nothing about it. And maybe the results of your work will confirm what you thought, and sometimes it'll change your mind. It really depends. Outside of that, you're going to need a strong work ethic. So a lot of the time, things happen outside of the 9-to-5 average workday, and you need to be open to the idea of working weekends, working holidays sometimes. Working when everybody else is asleep is how you get ahead. This is actually no different than what you hear from athletes. Your LeBron Jameses of the world, your Kobe Bryants, rest in peace, will say things like, the progress is made when everyone else is taking a break. So it really is kind of generic, work hard all the time kind of advice, but it actually applies to anything you do, and that includes journalism. So I would say honesty, objectivity, and work ethic are probably going to get you where you need to be.
Thank you for coming to speak with us today.
No problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Jody Cowan. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine at the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have any comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us online at social media at Media Sanctuary.
Welcome, Bert Weber, one of the co-founders of the Common Roots Brewing Company, which recently created the Common Roots Foundation, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Really interesting backstory. So I wonder if you could first share the story behind how you have now created. I mean, it sounds like you originally had this idea, but it's been kind of propelled through a story. So could you share that with us?
Certainly. Yeah. When we started the brewery about 6 years ago now, we knew that beer was always a good vehicle to kind of do good in the world, as we like to think of it. So, as the brewery started to, gain more success as a business, we started to see a lot of people reaching out to us in ways that we could help them. And so, we started to think about this because it's still a for-profit business, but, there was so much need in the community, and we really formed a business with this concept of being part of a community, promoting a healthy lifestyle. And, my son and myself are the founders of this, and we both have a strong environmental background, so we wanted to make sure that we could kind of do things in a sustainable way too. So with that in mind, we started this business and began to see the success with it. But as perhaps you know, on March 19th, 2019, we had a fire that destroyed our brewery. And it was really the reaction to that fire that we always realized we were kind of a part of a community, but we had not realized how large that community was. I mean, the South Glens Falls area is obviously one thing, but we had breweries reaching out to us from across the country and, doing fundraisers for us as a way of, down in New York City and out in Arizona. It was really, the word we keep using and maybe overusing is humbling to us. And while I would think nobody would want to be on have a fire is a pretty traumatic thing. Honestly, that night and the next day, we really had no idea whether we'd even survive as a company. So it was a difficult night for us. But then, within hours of the fire actually being out, we started to see all these social media posts and people reaching out to us and creating these, they created something called Rally for the Roots. And it was, it just blew us away. So we, when my son and myself, when we're done with this, we said, you know what? We have to find a way to pay this forward. So we brought this idea of the foundation up again. And you know, now that we're in our new facility and open again, we launched the foundation today, and it's feeling pretty good right now. So
wonderful.
That's awesome.
I mean, you mentioned a sustainable business. Could you talk about how your business is sustainable?
Well, you know, the brewery, starting a brewery is a big capital investment, and it obviously is energy intensive too, and water and things like that. So we do what we can to kind of mitigate those things. The new brewery has 100 kilowatt hour, whatever it is. I should know the size, but we produce it's a photovoltaic array on a roof. We also heat water solar. So we you know, the new building itself was constructed with all the energy efficiencies. Our grain gets recycled and reused at our local farms. So the spent grain gets used that way, and we recirculate some of our water too in the process of brewing to kind of cut down on that use. So as much as we can, we're very aware of it. It's an energy intensive business, but we've done what we can to kind of mitigate that and be more responsible stewards of the environment. Plus a lot of our fundraising and stuff in the past and in the future we expect will be to benefit certain environmental groups. So like on Earth Day, we came out with a beer especially called the Mom's Calling. And it was
a relaunch on Mother's Day too.
You can see the can there, but it had a little earth.
Oh, it's got a really nice label, a little bit like ocean. Can we describe the label? It's quite beautiful. So there's also an artistic element, isn't there?
Yes. Well, labels, as you know, in craft beer are very important. I don't know if you can see that, but.
Well, our listeners can't, but we can describe it.
So the iconic figure of Earth in space, but then above it, it looks like you see on your cell phone. Maybe if your mom was calling you, you might have a picture of her. So that was our thing. You know, we have to pay attention to our Mother Earth right now. So the proceeds of this beer went to 350.org, which is fighting climate change and making people more aware of the crisis that is for all of us. So,
and on that theme, it says your mission is to improve the quality of life in northeastern New York, specifically in the areas of community wellness, environmental stewardship, and assisting those in time of need. Could you go into a little bit more detail about what that means to you specifically and how you kind of got it, you know, your own roots in that?
Well, obviously those are three kind of pillars of our foundation there, and but they kind of speak to us as a business too. So, even as an active brewery, before we had the foundation, there were a lot of people just use us or ask us if we could help them with, let's say if they had a fire or a child that was with illness and things like that. So we used a lot of times the brewery as a fundraiser for that and participated. So that's the need of it. Environmentally, we in the past we had sponsored a 5K run for the river, we called it. And, the proceeds of that went to Riverkeeper. Obviously to make quality beer, you need good water. And water is a resource in the Northeast that we honestly take for granted right now. And many parts of the country, and I think maybe in our area here, that's going to be a very scarce resource for us. So we have to pay attention to these things that we're taking for granted right now. So and as far as that, also we sponsor, like we think a healthy community is an active community too. So I think from the first year we opened, we sponsored what we thought was a fun idea. My son and myself, my whole family really were avid bicyclists. So we sponsored this thing. We called it Gears and Beers. So if you came to our brewery usually around 6 o'clock we started, and we went for about an hour, hour and a half ride. And we gave everybody a token to come back and have a beer with us. And so it's kind of a reward for going out and doing something. And what started with about six people wound up being about 80 people. So it began to look like Tour de France pulling out of our brewery. And so we had to actually take that back and start to look at it. It became kind of a concern to us because there was that many people, and it became a liability for the company. But as I said, the foundation now is a much better vehicle for that. So actually the foundation, as part of their their organization here, they've actually taken out a USA cycling license. And so we're going to, the foundation's now going to sponsor the beer, Gears and Beers. And so any riders that come out and have a beer with us afterward, we're going to donate $1 per pint to the foundation. So
that's really cool. And it seems like that it's that kind of energy and that kind of love going into it that, that came back to you guys to when he had, when it was, when you needed to rebuild for yourself. I mean, I've had the beer before. I know it's good beer, but it had to have been more than the fact that you guys have good beer that the love came back to you, that people, this outpouring of support that came back for you to be able to rebuild. And it seems like you're trying to pay that forward, which is pretty fantastic. It says you will award grants and lend resources to initiatives related to its mission. Is this an idea still in development, or can you go into more detail about how someone could apply for such a grant?
Well, again, we're a very new foundation, but tonight, in fact, we're going to put the final approvals on some of the forms and stuff. But if you go to Common Roots, our website, the company's website, on one of the pull down menus, you'll see the foundation. And if you pull down that foundation menu, you can see that there's opportunities for grants and how to apply for a grant or get a what's the other thing, or give a donation. So we're actually working with AIMS Services right now, and they have a project on 518 United Ways. It's a volunteer day. So we're going to help them. They reached out to us, and they actually have a community garden in Schuylerville that's called the Common Roots Community Garden. So we thought, well, there's a match made in heaven for us. So we, you know, my background is actually in plant and soil science. And so, you know, having some experience that way. So it seemed like a natural. So that's actually going to be our first, proposal or a project that we do as a foundation. We're going to show up as volunteers that day. Plus, we're also going to make a donation to the garden because it's still in its kind of beginning stages. And so they have some structural needs and need for material, things like that. So
cool. Your organization's vision also includes social justice issues. Are you reaching out to social justice groups to let them know about this new resource? Are you making a point to reach out to low-income, black or brown, black and brown disabled and other marginalized communities to let them know about this resource?
Well, through the foundation, and you know, hopefully that is all part of it. And for us to reach out to those groups, we're hoping that with our mission and everything that groups and interested that we share that vision and that goal, that they'll feel very comfortable in reaching out to us in the future.
So you were talking about stewards of the environment, and we've heard bicycling and gardens. Could you talk about some of what you think are really important environmental initiatives to take place in? We recently were talking with on the show various speakers who were a part of a Sustainable Futures Conference here in the Capital Region. So looking locally, what are some of the important environmental organizations that you would like to work in, and what maybe listeners should integrate into their practice?
Specific environmental organizations that we work with. It's probably hard for me to put my finger on it because we, like we said, the beer release that we did on Earth Day is going to go to 350.org, which is a much kind of larger global organization. We've worked in the past and we'll continue to work with the Riverkeeper. Our brewery sits about 600 feet from the Hudson River. So it's a wonderful resource. And, you know, if you look at just the Hudson River and our resource in our area, it's a natural resource that's been kind of abused, honestly. I mean, with the factories and things that have kind of used it for not only for power, but also unfortunately as a dump site. And so, you know, that kind of past history has made it very difficult for us to look at in the future in this part of the region, of our country. So as I go back again, I'm looking at as water as a very critical resource and one in that we take for granted in this area. But it's one where I think we're going to really regret if we don't take care of that resource right now. In the past, I'm trying to think of some other things we've worked with, like our pollinators and stuff. A lot of the the ingredients that we use in brewery, in the brewing process, they're dependent on the health of our pollinators. And so we know how, like, our honeybee population and other pollinators are really in danger right now. And so, we kind of stress, like, when we did the landscaping in our brewery, we didn't use any turf grass because we don't want to use a lot of fertilizer or water, or pesticides, things like that. And the planting materials that we use as many native plants as we could, and those that were friendly to our local pollinators and ones that are migrating through the area. So, these are the kinds of things we're trying to kind of practice what we preach. And we work with the Audubon Society. We've had a membership drive for them in the Adirondack Mountain Club at our brewery. So, if the selling beer is kind of a fun thing because it's a good vehicle to do other good. And so when we see an organization like the Audubon Society or the Adirondack Mountain Club or other environmentally sensitive organizations like that, if we can help them by also including the idea of that, because the brewing community has a lot of fans and we can bring people together for some beer, music, and food. And if we can do some good by having you sign up for an organization that's important for the health of our planet and our community, then that's a win-win for us. So
I really enjoy that you're making these connections of course, water being incredibly important in beer making, as well as, hops and wheat, all these different pollinators. I love that you're making that connection. And as well as you said, a healthy lifestyle, which is not something, I think the stereotypical thought of a brewery is, not thinking about politics and sustainability and healthiness. And I love that is because it is it doesn't have to be that, and making those connections. And I guess I didn't have necessarily a question there, but I think that's really wonderful that we're hearing from more organizations that are really conscious that they aren't this little bubble in a community, but that it's really all interconnected, and that your survival actually runs into the survival of, say, artists. And you were working with, I believe, an artist on that label, that beautiful label you were showing us?
Oh, yes. Well, we have a graphic artist on our staff right now, and she's just remarkable. She's created the...
What's her name?
Jess Mead.
Wonderful.
Jessica Mead. So she's just does incredible work for us. We're so fortunate to have her. She designed the actual poster. So if you become a member or donate to the foundation as a member, you'll see that poster that she designed. And that's one of the things you can get for joining as the foundation. But I think brewers in general and people that love craft brewery tend to be very creative people. And so we're always looking for ways that we can kind of, make it a win-win for everyone. And going back to Jody's question, the brewing industry is also it's like 94% still a white person's industry. So we're very sensitive to being more inclusive with people of color and things like that. And it's certainly something that's on our radar, and to be, and not only to express that as a company, but to make sure we express that in our media posts and things like that too. So
that's great. Wonderful work. And I wonder if you could direct us to how to find you. Where's your website and where can we find your brewery?
Well, it's Common Roots Brewing Company.com. We are up in the beautiful South Glens Falls, New York, which is right over the bridge from Glens Falls, New York. We're about 15 to 20 miles north of Saratoga Springs. So it gives everybody perspective. The new brewery was designed to be a destination. So we're hoping people make the trip up. And when you're there, you'll please ask about the foundation and things like that. And you'll be able to see some ideas that way too. So
I have to ask about a quick update on Sparky. How's Sparky doing?
Oh, Sparky. Yes. That was, it was a few days after the fire there, and we were touring, walking around the old, what was going to be our temporary brewery. It was a building just literally half a block away from the existing brewery, and it was March, so it was cold. It was still snowing, and we're walking around with the contractor who's going to help us kind of renovate the place to get it ready to be our temporary, and I look down, there's this little hatchling turtle, and I'm like, what is this little guy doing here? So I picked him up. He was still alive. I put him in my coat pocket. Brought him home, and we set up a little turtle sanctuary in my kitchen, and we named him Sparky because, you know, there was some rumors, was it the fire that, you know, caused them to come out? And the, you know, but I think it was too far away. But he was, oh, God, he was probably a good, like I said, 1,000 feet from the nearest water supply. So I don't know what he was doing in that parking lot. But anyway, we raised him and found him, got him to a good size. And when the weather broke in the summer, we found a place, a good permanent home for him. So.
Fantastic. Okay. I need the news from the source directly here on that one.
it was a nice, he was a, you know, it gave us something to kind of focus on. And it was, we made it kind of symbolic of our, you know, being nurtured by our community and coming back from a very traumatic event for us. So it was a good story for us. And we miss him. We hope he's doing well out there, but it was fun.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us. There you go, Jody.
Thank you. Congratulations on the opening of the foundation, and we certainly look forward to following your endeavors.
Thank you. I appreciate the time, and best wishes.
Thank you. That was Bert Weber, one of the co-founders of Common Roots Brewing Company, joining us. Thank you.
All right. Moving forward, we have HMM producer Anna Steltenkamp speaks with Lila June, who is an internationally renowned public speaker, artist, scholar, and community organizer of Navajo, Cheyenne, and European lineages from Taos, New Mexico. This is the second segment in the multi-part dialogue with Lila June. Last segment, Lila ended emphasizing the importance of considering not only what we are doing through our actions, but also why, i.e. the reason, and the how, i.e. the process. In this segment, Lila speaks about the value of community-level organizing, as well as the effects of the notion of private property and the need to counter this idea in order to act in a manner that acknowledges and respects our correctedness throughout space and time.
I wear a lot of different hats. One of them is I'm a PhD student looking at the intersection of Indigenous food systems and Indigenous land management practices. And I'm also a musician, author of a poetry book, Lifting Hearts Off the Ground. But I think the things I'm most proud of are more like community organizing and bringing people together to learn Indigenous knowledge the best way that I can and working with my community.
Thank you for sharing that. Going back to your introduction and how you emphasize in your life the importance of community organizing, would you say that the value of community organizing is a part of this why and how that when you're working within your intimate kin relationships, you get more of that why and how out of it compared to there's sometimes this notion within Euro-American societies of we have to go out to make a difference, but sometimes it's about coming in.
Yeah, I think a lot, or not just a lot happens on the community level, but maybe even anything worth happening happens on a community level. And here's why, is that if the people themselves are not dictating their own solutions, it's always going to be a temporary fix. It's always going to mismatch what the community really wants. And I think in American society, we have really normalized top-down solution approaches where the government decides in Congress or in state level governments or even city councils, this is what we're going to do. And we get to say what we're going to do because you elected us last year. And so therefore we get to decide. And then everyone just kind of has to deal with it, whatever that is. And to some extent, you know, leadership is necessary. But at the same time, a lot of Indigenous communities back in the day were decentralized governmental structures in the sense that even down to the family level, there was sovereignty of what that family would choose to do, where they would be, et cetera. And it was only very recently that the Navajo Nation was formed, this formalized, centralized government. And that centralization of our Diné people, decision-making process has really harmed us, because then all oil companies need to do is bribe and distort those key leaders, and then it has control over the whole population. And that's actually why they created the Navajo Nation government in the Constitution, it says the reason for the creation of this government is to facilitate the exportation of quote-unquote natural resources from these homelands. So when you get to the community level, on the other hand, and you ask people, if you could have anything you want, what would it be? You know, that is such a powerful question. And that's actually what I wrote my master's thesis on in the College of Education at University of New Mexico, which was, hey, let's all make a summer school. And if you wanted to teach and learn anything, what would it be? And people have been so disempowered, and nobody asks them these questions for so long that sometimes we don't even know what to say if someone would ask us that. Like, I don't know, the president's supposed to figure it out, or the mayor, or the governor, when actually we are most suited to determine what should go on in our communities because we're the ones who live there. And yeah, we might make mistakes, but that's also good because we learn from mistakes and we refine. So I think community, like you said, looking inward for community creation, I mean, I've only done it once in a really deep, intentional way, and it was beautiful. I mean, we had over 200 Diné people come together and build their own school, and it was super popular. Everyone loved it. Everyone had, like, because it was made by the people. So of course everyone came because it reflected the hearts and the dreams of the people. And I think that's a really important process for any solution building we create.
On these comments about the consolidation of power and how a centralized government can be used then in forms as a weapon against the power of the people, I'm curious if you think that the relations to land play into that as well, and the settler logic of private property and the consolidation and individualization of that, how it has also been a way to consolidate and dispossess people of power and challenging the communal relations to the land and thus the communal relations between the people.
Wow, that is a very deep question that I never really connected the dots between the institution of private property and the centralization of power. You know, it's interesting you say that because in a way, private property decentralized power because everyone has their own little plot of land and they get to decide. But that form of decentralizing power has the opposite effect of what I'm talking about of decentralized government. Because even though it's decentralized and you have all these different people owning little plots, you lack the holistic, cohesive, connected nature of an ecosystem. Like, for example, the Chesapeake Bay, you know, Virginia, Maryland, what we now call Virginia, Maryland, had 10,000-year-old oyster fishery that the Algonquin nations harvested oysters, ate them, deposited them in these shell piles, ancient shell piles that we can look at, archaeologists can look at and measure. Wow, Algonquin peoples ate oysters out of this bay for 10,000 years sustainably. And not only that, but the shells actually got bigger over time, meaning they enhanced and augmented this food supply. And all the early explorers would marvel. They'd be like, wow, I have to like cut this oyster into thirds just to fit it in my mouth because they were so much bigger than the ones in Britain. And then today there's almost no oysters left in the Chesapeake Bay. It is almost completely collapsed within just 300 years of American mismanagement. The oyster population, everyone's like, oh my God, how do we save the oysters? How do we save the oysters? And it's so simple. It's the farmers upstream who have their private little lots, who just have their own little siloed universes that they don't have to be accountable to bigger systems that they're connected to. They bring all these fertilizers into the soil and those run into the rivers, which runs into the bay, which creates these pH levels in the bay that are not good for the oysters. And then meanwhile, the oyster fishermen, the American oyster fishermen, are dredging the bottom of the bay and just scratching the whole oyster bed out of existence to extract as much oysters as possible, because they don't have to be accountable to future generations who are going to need oysters. So this whole siloing ourselves in space and time, that, well, I have my little private property, so whatever happens outside of my fence line, my property line, my boundary line, I don't care. I don't care what happens out there, and I don't care how what I do here affects what happens out there. And you get what we have now is just all of the rivers are full of fertilizer. You know, these farmers are just destroying whole watersheds. And also they're isolated in time, right? It's like, they're not just thinking, I don't care what happens out of my property line. They're thinking, I don't care what happens out of my time. I don't care what happens next generation, two generations, because I'm focused on how many profits I can make in the next fiscal quarter. So we need to, instead of decentralizing that, and I think we kind of need to centralize that, of not centralize it, but connect it, create these connections of like, hey, all y'all in the, let's say, for example, the McLeod River Basin in California, you all are pretending like you're separate, but everything you do affects one another. And how do we work together on a watershed basis? That will be the next evolution of humanity on this continent.
Thank you for sharing that. And I hear what you brought up of going back again to this, why we do it, and this in Euro-American perceptions of it's for personal benefit, and all costs are perceived again on that personal level of, if it affects someone outside of myself, whether it's the more than humans, the landscape, the community down the stream, that's not understood as a personal cost. So reframing and understanding that the personal is a part of the collective reframes what is a benefit and what is a cost.
Yeah, and that's why the lack of private property, I mean, not all, some indigenous nations definitely did fall into the trap of private property, but they usually learned really fast that doesn't work. But, you know, that's why this imposition of private property has really shortchanged us, and we've lost out as humanity, because when we're not operating on holistic systems levels, we're not tapping into the forces of nature. We're not tapping into the larger forces at hand that could feed us really easily if we just work together, and not only feed us, but feed the whole system, the biodiverse system.
That was Lila June speaking with HMM producer Anna Steltenkamp. This is a multi-part segment, and tune back in to hear the rest of this conversation with Lila June, or head to our website to hear the full segment at mediasanctuary.org.
Next, we'll hear from Harmony and Taylor, two young girls who are excited to be able to learn about STEM while having fun. HMM correspondent Dulcinea Diggs reported from the Girls Inc. event.
Hello, this is HMM correspondent Dulcinea Diggs for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm here with two lovely ladies at Girls Inc., Harmony and Taylor. Harmony and Taylor are going to share their experiences here at Girls Inc. How are you doing today, ladies?
Good.
Okay, tell me, how old are you guys?
I'm 8.
I'm 9.
Wow, 8 and 9? Okay, so how long have you guys been a part of Girls Inc.?
I've been here for 1 year.
I've been here for 4 years.
Wow, 4 years? Wow, so 4 years, that's a long time to be with a group.
Yeah.
Okay, what has been your experiences here at Girls Inc.?
Mine has been really good, and one thing...
What do you do here at Girls Inc.?
We do, like, fun things on Fridays, and for program, we do... Sometimes we do dances, and we do, like, curriculum and stuff like that. And we do... And we play, like, games and stuff like that.
Okay, so you guys do curriculum. Tell me, what kind of curriculum do you guys do?
Like martial arts and stuff.
Martial arts?
Yes.
Wow.
And also, in March was our, like, our Women Month, so we were learning about different kinds of women who made change.
You've been here for 4 years, girl. I know you got more than that for me.
And also we do like arts and crafts sometimes. And sometimes we go on the computers and stuff and play games as well. And it's pretty fun.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you're having fun. And tell me, what is your favorite subject and why?
My favorite subject is math, because at first when something is hard, like once the teacher explains it to you, it's very easy. And that's pretty much why I went quick on the math state test. It was very easy because I'm like a fast learner.
Oh, okay. What's your favorite subject?
My favorite subject is math and science. The one thing I like about science is you learn different things. Like, you can do, for science, you can do, like, you can learn about, like, animals and stuff like that. And one thing I like about math is you kind of, like, math is fun. We can figure out lots of things. And math can help you with a lot of things, like cooking and stuff like that. So that's why I like math, because I like cooking, too.
So would you say math is really important for us?
Yes. Yeah, math is really important to learn.
Okay, now tell me, what do you want to be when you grow up?
I might be a tech engineer when I grow up, or an artist, because I'm good at drawing and painting as well, and I'm interested in technology, and I'm like, this place that I want, that might be my future job is about science and technology. So I'm learning like different kinds of science, and I might learn different kinds of technology.
Definitely. Well, I think you should go to tech, because tech is where the big bucks are. You like money, right? You like money? Okay. And what do you want to be?
I want to be a doctor and a teacher.
Wow.
I want to be a teacher because I like to help people like with math and science. And I like to read to people, and I want to be a doctor because you help people when they're sick, and you kind of think, it's like...
Any final words, girls?
What I like to say is Girls Inc. has helped me a lot, and it's like inspired me to like become like even more smarter and teach many other people and like help many other people, because one day we had like the homeless day, and we gave out food to the homeless, and that's pretty much it. I love Girls Inc.
I really like Girls Inc. has helped me with a lot, how to be better at like math, like a little bit more better at math. And
okay, ladies, thank you so much for this wonderful interview. I hope you guys enjoy your wonderful event today.
You too.
Okay, folks, well, this has been HM correspondent Dulcinea Diggs for WOC 105.3, and I spoke with Harmony and Taylor. We are here at the Girls Inc. event at Girls Inc. Be sure to check out Girls Inc. at girlsinccapitalregion.org.
Girls Inc. is an organization that focuses on showing young girls the importance of STEM learning, and that was brought to us by Dulcinea Diggs.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Jody Cowan.
And I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey, also your engineer.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org, through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thank you for tuning in.